Hello and welcome to The Sacred. I'm Elizabeth Oldfield, and this is a podcast about our public conversations and how we can better engage with those who believe, belong, and behave differently from ourselves. Before we kick off, I wanted to ask a really quick favour. If you haven't yet rated or reviewed the podcast on iTunes or wherever you listen to it, it would be really helpful for getting the word out. Today, you're going to hear a conversation with Ariane Shireen, who's a comedy writer, journalist, and in 2009 was creator of the Atheist Bus Campaign. She's written comedy for the BBC, for Channel 4 and beyond, journalism for The Spectator, The Guardian, The Telegraph, and The Sunday Times, among others, and is the author of The Atheist's Guide to Christmas. Her most recent book is called Talk Yourself Better, A Confused Person's Guide to Therapy, Self-Help, and Counselling. We spoke about why a traumatic abortion experience made her become an atheist, her struggles with mental health, what has changed since the bus campaign 10 years ago, and why she now doesn't mind if her daughter is a Christian. It was really illuminating talking to her, and I hope you enjoy listening. Ariane, we are going to ask you the really meaty question at the beginning of the podcast, to which there is no right or wrong answer and can make people a bit panicky. And I still don't know what mine are, but I am going to ask you to give your best guess at if there is a sacred value or some sacred values which you try and live your life by, that when they feel threatened, you feel quite compromised and quite torn, or that are just very dear to you. Does anything come to mind?
Well, when I was first thinking about this question, I thought of the obvious answers of love and empathy and kindness, but I don't always embody those qualities. And so then I thought on, and I thought maybe freedom to believe what we choose to believe, freedom to love who we want to love, and the freedom to act as we want within the boundaries of the law. But then, of course, does that go far enough? Because it's perfectly possible to act within the law and still hurt people. You know, I know I've just got divorced, and with my ex-husband, I certainly wasn't embodying kindness or empathy or love. You know, a lot of the time I would say things in anger, and you know, if you say to somebody, I hate you, or I don't love you anymore, or I don't like you, that can be devastating, but it's perfectly legal. But yeah, it certainly wouldn't fall into the values that I aim to uphold, or that I claim to uphold, but I would still, I'd still probably put them up there as goals.
I think I hope it's very fair to have a sacred value, which we often fail to live up to. I think that's part of the human condition, but it helps us to understand what other people are trying to make central in their lives. Because I think sometimes we react to things because our sacred values are under pressure, and we haven't been explicit about what ours are, and we haven't necessarily thought about what someone else's are. Lots of things that are happening in public debates look to me like they're clashes of sacred values. So I'm just trying to create some space for self-reflection, but I definitely don't always live up to mine. Let's wind back a bit then, so that listeners can understand a little bit about you and where you've come from and your story. So tell me a bit about your childhood, and particularly if there are any formative ideas that come to mind, whether that's a religious background or political or philosophical ideas that were formative on you.
Well, my childhood was pretty bleak, pretty joyless. It was quite harsh. My dad was a very strict disciplinarian, and he would hit me for virtually anything, from losing a pencil eraser to spilling my orange juice, not eating dinner, that kind of thing. And my mum was besotted with my dad, and she was basically an apologist for him. So whatever he did, she would say, oh, he did this because he was upset about you doing that. And that sort of not only normalized his behavior, but it also made me think that it was my fault that I was being hit all the time for all these different infractions. I started going to Sunday school when I was about 4 or 5, and my parents didn't come. So I'd go to this Sunday school and then to church. They didn't come. They were de facto atheists. They were, my mum was a Zoroastrian and my dad was a Unitarian Universalist. but they weren't practicing at all. So they'd stay home. And my mum later told me that I was sent to Sunday school to inoculate me against religion because she didn't want me to become a born-again Christian or an evangelical. And so I grew up aware of religion, but I always had questions and I always thought, hang on a sec, I've heard of this place called hell. And if you don't believe in Jesus, then you're going to hell. But that's not fair because my mum's a Zoroastrian and she doesn't believe in Jesus. And it's not fair that she should go to hell. And so by the time I was 11, 12, I was having school assemblies, and to make the other kids in my class laugh, I would sing all the hymns in a very strong Indian accent. So, and then our teacher would come up to me and she'd go, "Ariane, sing in your normal voice." And I'd go, "But I am Indian." So she couldn't really send a note home saying, "Your daughter's singing in an Indian accent."
I'd be fascinated to know what your mother's motivation for that was, whether she'd had some negative encounters with born-again Christians or evangelicals. It certainly sounds like there was perhaps some pain there, maybe.
So her aunt was a Jehovah's Witness. And I think that she had possibly, although I don't know and I'm estranged from her now, so I might never know, but I think she'd possibly experienced some kind of behavior that she perhaps didn't interpret as desirable. That's all I can imagine. But I didn't actually become an atheist until after an incident in 2005 when before that I would have described myself as Christian, loosely Christian. I mean, I would have ticked the C of E box on the census, though I didn't go to church. And I would have described myself as pro-life. And then I got pregnant in an abusive relationship, and I was violently attacked while I was pregnant. And my boyfriend, whose baby it was, hit me in the face, and he caused my ear to bleed so much that it soaked through a tissue. And then he held his hand over my face and told me that he was going to kill me. And after that, I was so devastated and so conflicted, and I came back to Britain and there was nothing I could do because it happened in abroad. And I thought, I couldn't press charges, and I was suffering from morning sickness, and I didn't feel able to go back abroad and try and press charges against him. And then nobody would support me at the time. And it was incredibly difficult. My parents shunned me. They basically said that unless I had an abortion, they weren't going to see me. And I really, really wrestled with it. And I wrestled with my conscience for almost 3 weeks, almost until the time limit was up for taking the pills. And I thought, you know, God wouldn't want me to do this. This is totally against everything. It's an innocent life. I can't do this. I wanted this baby. I've bonded with this baby. And it's not its fault that its father is a word beginning with W.
And it's okay. You can say wanker. He sounds like one.
So for a long time, I was so conflicted. And then I became very weak through the sickness. And I realized that he would want to see the baby and that I would probably have to hand it over to him despite what he'd done every weekend or every other weekend for the next 18 years. And given that my dad had been violent when I was a kid, I just thought, I can't give birth to the child of a violent man. And so I had the abortion, and I remember just crying so hard in the abortion clinic, BPAS, in Bedford Square. And I was just there and saying to the woman, the nurse, just tell me what to do. What should I do? What should I do? And she said, I can't tell you. And nobody could tell me, but more people, I mean, it was really just my parents and one other person who said that you should have an abortion. Everybody else, my friends, my literary agent said, you'll regret it if you have an abortion. And so I had the abortion, and afterwards I was so vulnerable. I thought, if I didn't want to fall asleep, because I thought, if I die in my sleep, I'll go to hell for what I've done. And while I was deliberating as to what to do and how to make the decision, I went online and there were all these websites, Catholic websites, with propaganda saying, if you have an abortion, you'll get breast cancer. If you have an abortion, you'll go to hell. And there were all these pictures of fetuses sucking their thumbs in the womb. And it was incredibly distressing. And I remember Googling, is abortion a sin? Does the Bible say abortion's a sin? And just trying to work it out from that. And it was one of the most awful experiences of my life, my nervous breakdown being the other. And eventually it turned me not just atheist, but very anti-religious, because I thought, I've had to go through this alone. There's no sign of God in this. God didn't stop my boyfriend from attacking me. God didn't tell me what to do. And I've just completely lost my faith.
Marianne, I'm so sorry for all of the things you've been through.
Thank you. It's not your fault.
No, it's not. But I think sometimes the appropriate reaction is just to acknowledge that that was really, really awful. And I'm really sorry that you went through that.
Thanks.
Almost feels inappropriate to ask my next question. So forgive me for the slight crunch of gears, but how much was there direct line between that experience and going on to set up the Atheist Bus campaign? I know, well, I've read that it was partly in a reaction to Bible quotes on the side of buses, and hearing that backstory really helps me understand why that will have been so painful for you to see those going by in the big letters. Was there a big time lag? Did that come about quite quickly?
It was 3 years afterwards, and there was almost a direct line. I'm pretty sure I would never have run the Atheist campaign if it hadn't been for what happened in 2005. And my ex-boyfriend, who turned violent, identified as a Christian. So, you know, you see in so many ways where I wanted to distance myself from Christianity, and I kind of became sort of allergic to any kind of propaganda, anything that I saw as proselytizing, especially if it had anything to do with hell or if it was scary in any way. And I know that not all Christians would endorse that or believe that, but to me at the time it seemed very binary, and it was like, you're either for this or you're against it. I'm against it. I'm going to push back. And at the time, there hadn't been any pushback in this country at all. There'd been no atheist advertising. So it really was the first time that any atheists who wanted to push back against religion had had any kind of voice. And that, I think, is why we saw this massive outpouring of, I don't know what you'd call it, I suppose passion, atheist passion. And you saw £100,000 being donated in 4 days, and some of it by Theos.
Yes, it was before my time, but I gather that the team talked about it and decided that actually just talking about the possibility of what we believe and what we don't believe in public is a good thing. And it had got people thinking about what they did believe and having honest and heartfelt conversations about it. So yeah, we bonged 50 quid your way, small in the scheme of things, but.
Well, thank you. I mean, I just didn't expect it to take off like it did. It really went crazy, and my phone was blowing up for days, and I woke up one morning and a very posh voice was at the end of the phone and said, hello, is that Ariane? I said, yes. I said, this is Joan Bakewell from The Times. I was like, oh, okay. I was literally just waking up. And so, you know, Joan Bakewell on one hand wanting to write about it, and Richard Dawkins supporting it, and Polly Toynbee and AC Grayling and all these people who I greatly admired. And it felt right at the time. Yeah, that's the only way I can describe it. It felt like I'd very much done the right thing.
And how do you feel about it now, looking back on it?
I think 10 years later, I wouldn't do it again today. But that's more because I'm aware of my own mental health and I'm aware of everything that comes with doing an atheist campaign. And that involves a lot of religious hate mail, unfortunately. The vast, vast, vast majority of it from Christians. And so I don't think I would have the robustness to run a campaign like that again today. But I do think that it was necessary. And I think that atheists having a voice is very necessary because we should all be able to express our views as long as they're expressed peacefully. And we should all be able to debate these huge questions. And for everybody who is, you know, fervently thinks that there is a God, thinks that there is an afterlife, thinks that we humans were created, there is somebody, I think, in British life who equally believes that we are random and we came out of evolution, which came out of a Big Bang, and that there is no God and that there is no reason and our life has the purpose and meaning that we give it. And that person deserves to be represented in public as much as somebody who's Christian or somebody who's Muslim or somebody who's Sikh or Jewish or Hindu or Zoroastrian.
Tell me, because reading the article that sparked it about seeing Bible verses on the side of buses, mm-hmm. I gather that one of the things you went to immediately was the Advertising Standards Authority to say, is this, you know, why is this happening? And there's an interesting thing there, I think, about the balance between freedom of speech and how we live our common life and how much we can tolerate being, I always talk about being existentially unsettled, right? You know, for a Christian, seeing your bus would have been existentially unsettling. For an atheist, seeing a verse with Bible verses might be existentially unsettling. Mm-hmm. You know, is that the price we pay for the freedom of speech to hold, to make truth claims in public? Or where have you landed on that now?
Yeah, I think it very much is. I live in Leytonstone, and when I come out of the tube, there are often Jehovah's Witnesses, and they try and hand me their leaflets and I say, no, thanks. I don't go, don't you know who I am? Which is like,
sort of think you should, because it would be funny.
But no, I mean, it's very much a live and let live thing.
As I was thinking about this, I was thinking back to that moment. Theos was launched in 2006. The bus campaign happened in 2009. It felt like between about 2005 and 2010, there was a real peak of was seen as kind of new atheist activity and responses to that, which has ebbed a little bit.
Yeah.
And I remember at the time being interested in the gender element of that.
It's funny that you should say that. I mean, one of the reasons why it has ebbed is because there have been a lot of arguments within atheism and skepticism about gender equality and some about sexual assault and some about the freedom to, for instance, there was an incident called Elevatorgate. I don't know if you heard about it.
I did, but I don't remember the details. Can you sketch it for me?
So a female atheist and skeptic said on, I think, a video, guys, don't hit on a woman in a lift. I've been hit on in an elevator and it's not pleasant. Richard Dawkins wrote a very scathing riposte to that, saying that it was nothing compared to what Muslim women go through. And so there was a kind of schism, and a lot of women felt that his response was unfair. A lot of his generally male supporters kind of pushed back with a lot of hate mail. And I guess it's like, it's just humans, isn't it? Humans argue, and this happens a lot within the church as well, which is why there's so many schisms and so many different factions. And so this has happened in atheism. I never felt as though I was being denied a voice. And I would say that there are actually, even in the book I edited, there are just more male celebrities, not just atheists. There are more male celebrities, full stop, which is probably why you find it.
When you're casting a panel or anything, it's just in whatever field, there tends to be more established men.
Exactly. And I wonder if that is because men from an early age are sort of imbued with the confidence to speak out and the confidence to be you know, not exactly loud, but noticed in public and to hold court. And women are traditionally expected to be quieter and be a bit more submissive and listen more and be thoughtful and nurturing and empathic. And so I wonder if it is harder as a woman to sort of push yourself forward and go, hey, I've got stuff to say. You should listen to me as well as, you know. So, yeah, that's...
That's a really interesting analysis of one of the reasons why that moment has ebbed. It's really struck me that I've had a lot of atheists on the podcast. I love talking to atheists. But many of them have explicitly distanced themselves from that new atheist moment. And we had a sociologist of non-religion on... I always want to call her Lois Lane, but she's not. She's called Lois Lee. And she says in her field work, the atheist but not a Richard Dawkins atheist is almost a like category in her quantitative coding in her research. Are there other reasons that you think that's happened? And do you feel some of that yourself?
I think that part of it is due to a shift where people have realised that a lot of atheists are very... anti-Islam, and they feel that this is racist, and I think that this kind of, whether this is true or not, it's certainly meant that people don't want to be seen to be allied with people who are making inflammatory or unfair statements. So I think that's another part of it.
You wrote a beautiful piece a few years ago about, and the line that really stood out to me, because I have two small children and I'm thinking a lot about how you teach values, what you teach. Both my husband and I came to Christianity a bit later in life. So we really fear that thing you've talked about, basically Sunday school inoculating them against it. So like, how can we allow space for them to discover it for themselves with a bit more of an adult mind, so it doesn't get like so oversimplified as to become like cartoonishly warped, which is what I think can happen when you're trying to teach it to children. But you said something about you're less interested in whether your daughter grows up to believe in God or not, as long as she's kind. Why have you been thinking more about kindness than you have about campaigning for atheism?
Because I realized that my priorities had shifted when I became a mum. And I realized that it really isn't that important. I want my daughter to be happy. And I think you can be just as happy and possibly happier as a religious person than you can as an atheist. I mean, there's certainly evidence to suggest that religious people are happier and live longer. I'm obviously still an atheist. I don't attribute that to any kind of God. I would attribute it to the sense of community and the sense of togetherness that religious people can feel. But going back to my daughter, it's quite funny because she came out a year or so ago and she said, "Mummy, I'm a Christian." I said, "Oh, are you?" She said, "Yeah, my childminder has told me that if you believe that Jesus died and came back, then you're a Christian." I said, "Oh, right. Okay, fine. That's fine." I was very, very taken aback. But you
how
know,
old is she?
She's 7 now. And she still says she's a Christian. I haven't tried to talk her out of it, but she did have an assembly a few weeks ago where they were taught about Noah's Ark. And I was a little bit worried that they were being taught about it as if this is true. And I said, you do know that that's not true, isn't it? And she hung up the phone on me. I called back and I said, "Why did you hang up?" And she said, "Because you were being disrespectful to religion. And that's not nice."
Wow.
But it's always going to be the way. I think if you're a massive atheist, your kids are going to be religious. And ditto, you might find that your little ones turn into atheists. I think there's a natural... need to rebel. But, you know, if my daughter remains a Christian, that's fine. I suppose it will mean that I have fewer things in common with her. But then, given that I've tried to make her childhood as beautiful as possible, I already have a lot of things that I don't have in common with her. And that's as it should be.
Before we move on, I want to ask you a question that I ask most people, which is, what would you say to particularly religious people, that they could do better when they talk in public? I think the people who are really kind of tribally committed to engaging in trench warfare probably don't listen to this podcast, but there will be a lot of people who are very committed Christians, people from other religions, who might unintentionally or just out of a lack of knowledge talk to or about atheists in ways that are painful or annoying. And I always ask people to share if there are those things, just so that we can all learn and we can engage better across our differences. Is there any piece of advice you'd share?
I suppose we're often being asked how we can be good people. Like, how can you be a good person if you don't believe in God? And that is quite an annoying question. And the standard atheist riposte is, if you need God to be a good person, then you're not really being a good person, because you're doing it because you're scared of the consequences if you don't do it. So that's definitely one of the points I'd raise.
Talk to me about your most recent book, which is about mental health and recovery. It's called Talk Yourself Better, A Confused Guide to Therapy, Self-Help and Counselling. Is that right?
Yeah, A Confused Person's Guide to Therapy, Counselling and Self-Help.
Great. How did that book come about?
So I had a major nervous breakdown after receiving all the hate mail from the campaign. And from 2010 to 2013, I didn't write in public, and my journalism career was just at an end, really. And I eventually, once I got back up and running and writing again, I had a Facebook friend who was an academic psychology publisher, and he said, oh, you should write something for my friend who's a commercial psychology publisher. And I thought, well, you know, I'm not really sure what I could write, because even though I've been really interested in therapy for a long time, I've been in therapy since I was 15 years old, on and off. And I even did a year of training to become a therapist. I quit after the first term of my degree and my introductory course. So I'm not qualified. But what I could do is write about therapy as a client, and what's it like to have therapy, and what's it like to talk about all your darkest fears and the thoughts that you can't voice to other people, because they might shun you, or they might, you know, run away screaming. So I pitched this idea of this book taking an honest and sometimes funny, very human look at what it's like to have therapy. And I luckily got a book deal for that. And I interviewed 46 different people about what it's like to have therapy, and also therapists about what it's like to practice it. And it's been fascinating. It's been so revealing. And I feel that I have insights into human nature now that I didn't have before I started researching this book. It's just been a wonderful journey. It's some amazing people to take part in it. Both celebrities like Stephen Fry, Charlie Brooker, David Baddiel, all atheists, but that wasn't the criteria. And some other celebrities, I don't know their religious persuasion. So Dolly Alderton, James Brown, Cosmo Landisman, Musa Okwonga, and then lots of people who you might not have heard of, but who also have fascinating stories. So, yeah, it's been an absolute delight to put together, and I'm really, really proud of it.
I was thinking as I was reading about it that it feels like for many centuries, religious communities and religious services was where people would go with their internal worlds, and the practice of confession and community and stories of meaning and purpose were at their best where healthy internal worlds could be grown and sought. And I wonder if therapy is increasingly filling that hole, because in public life, we're really not allowed to, we don't seem to create much space for reflecting honestly on our values and our internal worlds, except as a kind of live your best life, you know, personal development, values of the market kind of thing. The more vulnerable journey of a human spirit is more hidden. Do you feel like it's fulfilling that almost priestly role?
Therapy. Well, possibly. I mean, I've never done confession or taken confession. So I'm not entirely sure how you would feel, but I imagine that being absolved of your sins, so to speak, might be like the sense of lightness that you get when you walk out of a therapy room. And it's not so much that the therapist thinks that you've sinned or that you have anything to absolve, but he or she will talk to you and accept what you say without judgment. They'll keep it confidential, as I imagine a priest will. And so I think there are some parallels, because you just feel accepted and you often feel loved, or at least liked. The difference is you don't need to do any penance. You don't need to say any Hail Marys or anything. So, yeah, it is different. And I guess that the priest probably doesn't ask questions, or too many questions, about it. And I think that these questions that you do get asked during therapy are what encourage you to examine yourself and your behavior and to say, well, what can I do differently in future? How can I change myself to become better? But then again, you know, I guess that's what religion's about, trying to become a better person.
It feels like mental health is one of the few good news stories of our public conversations, that actually, bizarrely enough, you know, Prince Harry and Prince William talking about mental health and all the amazing work that's been done by Mind and other mental health charities, and more people in public life feeling able to be open and transparent about their mental health. Do you feel like things are improving for people who have struggled with mental health? And is there anything that would help us more broadly as a society get even better at these kind of discussions?
I do think that things are improving. I would like to see even more understanding. I'm very lucky that at work I have an amazing boss. He's just great. And he said to me, if you ever feel depressed or anxious, then, you know, just let me know and you can work from home, or, you know, you can take some time off. But I think not every boss is like that, especially in professions where it might be a lot more, things might be a lot more formal, you know, maybe in the law or in other places. Not having worked in them, I can't say for certain, but I get the feeling, especially from people that I've spoken to who have mental health problems, who say, you know, I don't want my boss to know. And I think that's such a shame. But at the same time, there are these employee assistance programs now where they try and get you help really fast, private psychological help. And they're not entirely out of the kindness of their hearts. They are designed to get employees back on their feet again as soon as possible and being productive. But I think it's a really good thing, and I'm sure that it helps a lot of people. And that is something that just didn't exist 20 years ago, or maybe even 10 years ago. So yeah, that's, I think, a really positive step.
It's nice to end on something positive that's happening in our common life. Ariane, thank you so much for coming to speak to me today.
You're so welcome. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Sacred. I'm Elizabeth Oldfield. The producer of this episode is Nate Bethay, and it is a project of the think tank Theos. We'd really love to hear your thoughts, whether via Twitter at @sacred_podcast or me at @theoselizabeth or thesacredpodcast@gmail.com if it's easier to write in long form. As always, please do rate and share so others can find the podcast. We're also now available on Spotify, so it's even easier to take The Sacred with you wherever you go. Finally, if you'd like to know more about the work of Theos, you can connect via the website at theosthinktank.co.uk.